Orleans, this is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. This week, we're revisiting some of our best moments from the past year. We've got a music lesson from John Cleary, who plays piano with a New Orleans accent. Shannon Powell opens up about drummers and the girls who won't date them.
I don't know. I'll be totally honest with you. I just think it's the beast in us.
Beasts of the Southern Wild filmmaker Ben Zeitlin discusses his headbanging past. And piano player Marcia Ball does some of her best living between albums. All that and much more on this special edition of Music Inside Out. Stay right where you are. The connection runs deep between John Cleary and other Louisiana piano greats. Here's his rendition of the Fats Domino classic, I'm in Love Again, all by myself. Bonnie Raitt makes the song all the more impressive. John Cleary was born and raised in England, but at some point early in life, he became yet another Louisiana musician who talks kind of funny. Cleary says he plays the piano with a New Orleans accent. Can you hear it? The aha moment for you, you know what I mean, when you decided, you know, maybe the piano is my future?
Well, we had a piano in my house when my grandmother, whose stage name was Sweet Dolly Daydream, when she was a young girl, she lost her arm in an accident. With the compensation money, she bought a grand piano. She spent one arm, she spent all the money on a piano.
Wow.
And that piano is still now, and she gave it to my mum and dad, and that's the piano I grew up playing with as a kid. We'd like use it, we'd drape tents, drape sheets over it and pretend it was a camp, or we'd climb on top of it or hide things in it. It was just a great thing to play with, and occasionally you start banging on all the notes, and then I started figuring stuff out, and so I really started messing with the piano quite young, but I didn't really take it seriously until I came to New Orleans.
Yeah, about when was that?
That was about 1981, something like that, and I didn't bring a guitar with me. And the house that I moved into had an upright piano.
Terrific.
And so all of a sudden, here I'm in New Orleans, I'm hearing piano music. one of the best piano players ever came out of New Orleans, played in my local bar every Tuesday night, and so I would hang out at the bar all day. I see him all the time, James Booker.
Oh, boy.
And so when I get home, I'd sit down and just try and figure out, you know, I'd spend all my money on records, on Huey Smith records.
Sure.
And would get off of work and go home and just sit there and play the piano and figure it out.
That's pretty great. What was your job back then?
I was a banana tree digger-upper.
Of course you were.
First of all. I wasn't bad at that, but that's hard work, man.
That
digging up banana
work.
Trees is really hard work. So I graduated from that to laying a brick patio behind the maple leaf, which is still there. And you can, it's so gnarly and wobbly. It's a sort of sorry testament to my inadequacy as a bricklayer. And then despite that, the owner of the bar very graciously offered us the job of painting the bar. And the deal was we could get to see all the bands for free.
Mm-hmm.
We got half-price beer at night, and we got free beer while we worked. Free whatever we wanted to drink, only in New Orleans. And we could work whatever, however many hours we wanted a day.
Oh, boy.
And so a job that should have taken 6 weeks took us 6 months. This is me and my mate from school who'd just flown, come over. So it was 6 months covered in paint, doing the worst painting job. But I think because at that time the bar was very popular with people in the construction industry, they realised that despite the fact we were such lousy painters, we were actually paying for ourselves, because all the construction guys would come and to watch, to see what a bad job we were doing and fall about laughing. They'd all get their beers and come out and watch us. Like, we're rolling about on the floor laughing as we were dropping paint cans on the sidewalk and accidentally painting our heads green as we were trying to balance a gallon of paint and a Dixie beer at the same time.
Wow, it's like reality TV.
Oh, man, when you were 17 or 18 years old, it was great.
But now you can actually say, you know, I built the Maple Leaf, or at least I kind of built the Maple Leaf.
Well, I splattered it with a shade of green paint. I think it would probably be more accurate. But we had a ball, and it was great, and I got to see all this amazing music.
In those early days when you were listening to James Booker, did you ever figure out what the heck he was doing? I mean, a lot of people have dedicated a lot of time to figuring out what James Booker was doing on that piano that made it sound so good.
A lot of people dedicate a lot of time just to trying to figure out what James Booker was doing, piano or no piano. What on earth was that guy doing? He was a character. He was given scant respect, really.
Yeah.
Now he's dead and gone, and in the grand pantheon of New Orleans piano players, he's assumed his proper role as one of the true greats. Back in the day, Tuesday night, you'd be lucky to get 10, 15, 20 people in there sometimes.
So you started off as a sideman. How did that, you know, how did you grow your reputation as a sideman?
Well, I think whatever reputation I might enjoy, I sort of enjoy it by default, really. I'd always been on a bit of a quest. But when I started playing piano, I started playing New Orleans piano. But at the time I came here, there weren't many people that really had much interest in that stuff, amazing to say. I mean, so I think I kind of got hired by default because there wasn't anybody else that could do it. So I got hired by Earl King. And when it came to Lonely, Lonely Nights, I knew how the piano solo went, and he nearly fell over. And how on earth do you know that?
How does
he
it
wasn't
go?
Wasn't used to younger cats. Well, it's like, you know. Boy, I've been so long, I can't remember. That kind of Toots Washington, Huey Smith
kind of style.
Anyway, so I got to play with Earl King, and then it went on. I got to play with guys like Tommy Ridgely and Ernie Cato and Jesse Hill.
Oh, the good guys.
All the guys that invented New Orleans R&B, really.
On your first album, which was Alligator Lips and Dirty Rice, which is a great title. You do a lot of covers. I mean, the whole album is in covers, but a significant number of songs are covers. And, like, including, like, Big Chief, which is so fabulous. Do you feel like, as an artist coming into this area, that you have to show people what you know of the classics before you can, you know, introduce your own music?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, that recording session came about at short notice, and I had to come up with some songs that I knew everybody could play and songs that I was comfortable with. And we'd actually just played the weekend before in Houston. A club owner in Houston had asked me to put a big band together for a special anniversary or whatever. So I hired my dream band at the time, which was, you know, George Porter and Bunchy Johnson and a bunch of horns and stuff. And John Brovin in England made it possible for us to go in and just do the same thing in the studio. So we basically did our gig.
Right, you said.
That whole record was recorded and mixed in 24 hours. So, you know, warts and all, that's what you got. If you got back and put it out, ooh, sick if I wanna make this shot now. I'm rolling down to get my soul. My dumb time's on the wall. Be big chief, I'm feeling good. I'm gonna do anything I could.
That's John Cleary. You can hear our entire interview with him, which includes a lot of great music, at musicinsideout.org. Now, here are some folks to tell you how you can support WWNO, the station that supports Music Inside Out, each and every week. This is Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen Tompkins. We're talking with drummer Shannon Powell, whose resume unfolds like a music lover's dream. In 1995, he accompanied the great New Orleans vocalist Johnny Adams on an album called The Verdict. Some of the city's heaviest hitters played on that record, which featured Harry Connick Jr. and David Torkanowski on piano, Houston Persons and Tony DeGrotte on saxophone, and James Singleton on bass. This song is called I Cover the Waterfront, and on it, Shannon Powell shows that the secret to being a heavy hitter is knowing when to use a light touch.
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea. Well, the one I love be coming back to me. I cover the waterfront. In search of my love. And I'm covered by a starless sky above.
Damn. That's all I can say.
That's true.
I mean, you can smell the cigarettes and the scotch and the voice and the atmosphere, and you are putting him right there in front.
Yes, yes. Smooth, silky, silky, silky.
How do you do that?
Wow. Well, like I tell a lot of my students when I'm teaching them how to play the brushes, and some of them they have a tendency to rush. And I tell him, I said, look, man, this is like making love, man. You got to think of caressing your wife or your woman when you're playing the brushes. It's a laid-back thing, and it's not no rush thing. You know, to get the sound that you just heard, now this is a slow motion and relaxed.
Yeah.
We're not in a rush. And John is laying right in there with the groove. It's so beautiful. Every time I hear that song.
It is beautiful.
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea for the one I love must soon come back to me. For the one I love must soon come back to me.
One, two, three, and... See, that's four. One, like, you can slow it down. Two, three, four, and one, two, three. See what I'm saying? It's saying when you're doing a fast tempo. One.
You in a hurry?
Yeah. Yeah.
This is after lunch when you have to walk back to your job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's when you get off from work.
Right?
How come drummers have such a bad reputation? Meaning, most people don't want their daughters to date a drummer, okay?
I've been there.
All right. So, you know what I mean? Not to say that the other band members are not culpable, but drummers have a reputation of being kind of feral. You know? Wild children.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's that come from?
I don't know. I'll be totally honest with you. I just think it's the beast in us. I mean, can you guys have a little beast in you that want to beat on something? You know what I'm saying, all the time. But I went through that when I was in my 20s. I had young ladies' fathers tell them to don't even fool with a musician, not just a drummer. You see, girl, if you want to eat, you better get you a real man because he ain't going to make no money. He ain't a musician. A drummer, too? He ain't going to make no money. So, you know, but I've had a lot of girls tell me that too. Say, I don't know, Shan, I like you a lot, but you're a drummer. I'm like, okay. And I'm a damn good one.
Yes.
I said, what's the problem? I don't know. I was told the drummers, y'all not faithful. I said, what? Look at my face.
Well,
do I look like an unfaithful kind of guy?
Well, if anybody understands the term two-timing, a drummer might.
I'm going to use that, yeah. I'm going to use that. You're mine, my partner.
You can have it. You can have it for free. The irrepressible Shannon Powell is, according to Powell, the best drummer in the world. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out. If movie music tells us who's who on screen and where the action is taking place, then what do you make of this original song? Of the Southern Wild turns on the story of a little girl called Hush Puppy, who lives in the southernmost reaches of Louisiana, which is to say, surrounded by water and quickly losing ground. Hush Puppy lives with her dad, but the absence of her mother from their lives is a matter of hurt, ambiguity, and longing. Dan Romer and Ben Zeitlin found a way to communicate this musically with original composition and a song from Tin Pan Alley. Director Ben Zeitlin joins us here at Elephant Quilt Studios in New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
What is your background in music?
I don't really have a formal background in music. My friends asked me when I was in seventh grade if I would join their band because they thought I was the one who could scream the loudest.
Can you?
At that time, I was going through puberty, so I had a real high, shrill shriek that they thought was perfect for the kind of, Nirvana derivation they were after. So I basically started singing in that band. I taught myself how to play guitar. I started writing songs for that band. And that was like my entire life through high school. And basically, you know, writing for when I started getting more interested in movies, I didn't want to stop writing music. And I kind of transitioned through writing for theater and then eventually started writing music for my own films.
And so where did you grow up? Where were you in seventh grade when you were doing your Nirvana imitation?
I was in a town called Hastings, which is right above New York, which I moved to. I grew up in Queens and then I moved to Hastings. And was completely shunned from society. And so this moment where these guys asked me to be in a band was like the first good thing that had happened to me living in this new town. And so it really became a huge part of my life.
Wow, that's interesting. So how good is your shriek today? Can you really shriek?
I can still scream pretty loud.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Can you give us an example?
there might be a connection between great film directors and great screamers. Somebody on set has to get everybody's attention. Film director Ben Zeitlin appeared on our show, dedicated to movie music. You can hear the whole thing, including conversations with NPR's Bob Bondello and composer Terrence Blanchard, online at musicinsideout.org. But first, listen to the good people here at WWNO. They're going to tell you how to support the station that makes Music Inside Out possible.
There's a woman in Austin who wrote a book, or who created a book called What Men Know About Women, and you open it and it's completely empty. It's a $5 book full of blank pages, and she sold like 1.5 million of them. Don't you wish you'd had that idea?
That's Marcia Ball. This is Gwen Tompkins, and we're talking to each other on Music Inside Out. Ball sings about all kinds of relationships, even the ones that go pear-shaped.
But there's probably not that many real interpersonal relationship songs in my repertoire.
Let's go to the paperwork, Ms. Ball. Okay.
let's Google that. Somebody asked me one time, why did you sing about hitting men so much? I said, oh, God, I didn't think about that. You have to be careful about what you put all together.
Well, nowadays, times have changed a lot, I have to say. Not in the sense that one day, you know, hitting people was fashionable and today it's not, but just that it is a sensitive topic.
Definitely.
And because there's more awareness about, you know, violence in relationships and all, then, it's not as easy to write a song, I guess,
which
these days about it.
Which brings us to St. Gabriel.
Which brings us to St. Gabriel.
Exactly.
Where does that song come from?
That's a true story.
Really?
I have a friend in Kansas who is a newspaper reporter, and he heard about this woman who had been in jail for 10 years. For killing her husband. And she was a classic abused wife. It was a self-defense situation. She hit him with a hammer. He broke down the bathroom door and she was where she was cowering. And here's the story, too. In the bathroom was an ice pick and a hammer because she had hung a razor strop on the wall next to the sink earlier that day. And when he broke down the door after beating her up and got in the bathroom, she hit him with the hammer. She didn't stick him with the ice pick. She hit him with the hammer to keep him away from her. And he fell down, and apparently she didn't even run or didn't realize. She just went basically and got in the bed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And later when she got up, he hadn't moved. Yeah. Well, ultimately she served 10 years. And when my friend Dave Ranney found out about her, and she had been denied parole, he wrote about her, and he wrote her story. And the next time she came up for parole, she was released.
the sad songs about leaving, none about coming home. I've been down in St. Gabriel with nowhere to go. The sun sets in St. Gabriel, a fiery red, and the fields all around are brown and dead in St. Gabriel. They say I killed a man. They threatened my life, but I went to prison because I was his wife, and I had stood it as long as I could. Oh, I went down to St. Gabriel for what I had to do. Oh, St. Gabriel, St. Gabriel.
So I wrote the story, but of course I said it at the women's prison here in Louisiana. She's been in jail for 10 years, and she's standing out by the road, and she's got no place to go.
Exactly. Exactly. And when you say in the song that you can feel the river,
yeah,
you know what I mean, through the walls, I mean, that, it's a very powerful image that, I guess, talks about the river of life.
Well, you kind of have to have been to St. Gabriel to know how close that is, and the, you know, the dead, the fields, and the sunsets and everything.
Anyway, so when you think about these prisoners in this prison and they feel the river moving outside the wall, then it's, you know, it's life passing them by, mm-hmm, to such a large degree.
Yeah.
It's really strong. You know.
Thank you.
And very sad.
Yes.
You know, very sad.
St. Gabriel. St. Gabriel.
I don't want to make our talk about relationships all sound like it's about fisticuffs.
Bad signs,
not,
you know?
Yeah, not.
But I think that you brought out the gentleman in Mac Rebennack.
Oh, wasn't,
you know,
that
and Dr.
Neat?
John. Oh, boy, yeah. And this duet that you all do, which is called I'll Never Be Free.
Right.
It's got that 50s feel to it almost.
Well,
huh?
You know what happened was he pitched me that. Basically, one time we worked a gig together up the country, Cincinnati, I think, and we were talking, and he said, there's a song you need to do. It's called I'll Never Be Free. You need to do it as a duet with somebody. Maybe me.
Now that's a salesman.
So I called him on it.
Each time I hold somebody new, can take your place, darling, in my embrace. I'll never be free.
What's so neat about about it is the way you all finish each other's thoughts in the song, the way you all arrange the vocals.
Yeah.
You know, you sound like people who'd been together a long time. Aww. And who, you know. Which album is that? Let me find this. This is on what?
On the So Many Rivers.
No, Peace, Love, and Barbecue.
Like I said, it was on the Peace, Love, and Barbecue. Yeah, and we used Max Rhythm Section. We used David Berard and Herman Ernest.
Oh, boy. But, you know, it's funny because you record an album, or at least you release an album every 2-3 years, something like that, right?
Right.
And so, which suggests that you're doing a little living between the albums.
I have plenty of living to do. And also, I just don't think the world needs an album from me every year. And I don't really write a bunch of songs until I feel like I have something to say. And so I try to make them worth getting. I guess by the time I get one out, people are ready.
That's Marcia Ball, piano player extraordinaire. Our friends at WWNO are ready to take your call. Here they are with the details. Here's the worst-kept secret in all of broadcasting. The people who put together Music Inside Out each week love Louisiana. We love radio. And we love a well-turned phrase. This past year, nearly every guest on Music Inside Out has surprised us with nothing short of poetry. Here's clarinetist and scholar Dr. Michael White. His description of day-to-day life in New Orleans blew our socks off. Take a listen. Dr. White grew up in Uptown New Orleans, the son of a letter carrier and a homemaker. White says he didn't commit fully to the clarinet until he heard traditional jazz great George Lewis play on a rare recording. Lewis's version of Burgundy Street Blues changed White's life, and we want to know why.
It just opened up and expressed what it felt like to be from New Orleans. It was like all of the things that are unique and special about New Orleans life and living. The way people laugh, gumbo, the smell of the cut grass and flowers in the spring by City Park, the bayou, the river, being around the French Quarter, going to fish fries and penny parties, having people sit out on their stoop, learning your news from them, going to local restaurants and meeting strangers. All of those things that are very unique about the city. It seems like all of those things were in the music. And it seemed to be historic, but at the same time, timeless. And I guess what that really was, as I look back on it, it was that it transmitted a spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the real spirit of New Orleans and the real spirit of the people of New Orleans and the people that created this music.
That's a lot. That's a lot of weight to put on one song, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm not the only person. I mean, there are other people that, you know, that song, they say it changed their lives in one way or another. I've heard that all over the world. It's a magic song, I have to tell you.
Thank you.
clarinetist Dr. Michael White. You can find his Ode to Life in New Orleans on our website, musicinsideout.org. Next up, there's nothing more attractive than a man who knows how to say thank you. Here's John Cleary, again with a tribute to his friends and longtime bandmates, the Absolute Monster Gentlemen.
The Absolute Monster Gents are Big D on guitar, Jeffrey Jellybean Alexander on drums, and Cornell Williams on bass. And they're longtime friends of mine. Cornell and Big D used to be in a band called the Friendly Travelers gospel group. That was my favourite band in New Orleans. And then one year, whereas previously I'd always used the old session guys in New Orleans, one year I got called to put a band together for Jazz Festival. And I'd been writing a lot of songs, and people would always say to me, why don't you do any of your own songs? I'd say, well, because I don't have a budget to rehearse, and it's hard to get the old curmudgeonly jazz musicians to put the extra effort in. They just want to come make the gig, have some have good fun and go home, you know. So I thought, well, let me do it differently this year. So I'm going to call a couple of the cats from the Friendly Travelers, my friends, and see if they want to just do it. But, you know, we'll do it right and rehearse and work on some original songs and do something different. So I called them and they said, boy, what's taking you so long? We've been waiting for this call for ages.
Aww.
Which was really nice to hear. I said, of course we can. So we got together and started working on material, and we said, well, can we get to play drums? And they both immediately said, well, you've got to get Jellybean. And I wasn't familiar with Jellybean, but we all went down to Bourbon Street to hear Jellybean. And we all sat in, and it was great. So Bean joined the band, and it fast became one of, I think, without wanting to sound like I'm boasting, I think it was one of the best little bands in town. Enjoy something of a cult following outside of town. Cult followings are usually small followings by definition. And it's the perennial challenge to go out and make enough money on the road to make it work. Funny enough, one of the places that really, really embraced us early was Australia.
Wow.
And do have and sell lots of records in Australia, and we still have lots of fans out there.
On your 2002 album, which is self-titled, John Cleary,
yes.
You know, you write the most beautiful ode to your band members. I wonder if you might be able to read a little from it.
Ooh, this is going to be embarrassing.
Well, you're not going to cry or anything, are you?
Try and hold back the tears. Probably more embarrassing, but the fact my eyesight is so bad.
Well, these are just reading glasses.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. When all the elements are in accord and the monster gents are digging a trench a mile wide in the early hours of a Sunday morning at the Maple Leaf Bar, when the mercury in thermometers is shattering glass and you can slice the humidity out in the streets with a wave of your hand, when the spirit's in your soul and the groove takes control, and when you close your eyes and feel like you've been lifted 6 feet off the floor, that's the moment when there's not a man alive that can possibly feel greater satisfaction. Cornell, Big D and Jellybean, as well as being among my best friends, absolute monster musicians in their respective fields, soulful scholars and gentlemen, are bloody good fun to be around and a pleasure to share the stage with. To have the funkiest band in a city that's renowned for having the funkiest bands in the world is a rare privilege. Thank you, fellas. Yeah, I'd stand by that. I wrote that a few years back, but I'd stand by that. Yeah.
That is stunningly gorgeous.
Oh, thank you very much. Well,
it
it's
really
easy to write
is.
Stuff like if you mean it.
But I like that phrase so much, digging a trench a mile wide in the early hours of Sunday morning. Tell me about that image. I mean, when you're playing on stage and digging that trench, as you put it, I mean, what is that like? I know what it's like to be in the audience, but I don't know anything about what it's like being on stage.
Well, musicians always talk about the groove, a trench a mile wide, that's a hell of a groove.
Exactly.
You know, and you can play a song as much as in the same way as you can recite a poem or you can have a conversation. But there are certain moments, as I think I alluded to it there, where it just seems like all the elements are in accord. It's inspiration. It's about being inspired. And inspiration, by definition, is something that's elusive and rare and delicate and hard to attain or achieve or capture or trap, whatever the correct verb would be. But there have to be all sorts of other things. You have to have a good sound. You have to have a good audience. You have to be in a good mood that day. There's all millions of variables, any one of which can prevent it from happening. But every once in a while, when it does happen, it's huge.
I ain't putting nobody down. Don't rock nobody roll. How you found gonna be funky people if you can't cook it with soul? Why we got no hipper than what you got.
The one and only John Cleary with an ode to his bandmates, the Absolute Monster Gentlemen. Producing a radio show in New Orleans is a privilege, and your support makes what we do possible. Coming up, our friends at WWNO are going to tell you how to be an absolute monster friend of the station. It's Music Inside Out. I'm Gwen, the Quiet Storm, Tompkins. Songwriter Alex McMurray is with us, and we've got extra chairs because he's got a lot of imaginary friends. McMurray crammed a few of them into his latest CD titled I Will Never Be Alone in This Land. This song is called The Get-Go.
He was a flunky from St. John's Spit. He told himself that he was through with it. So tired of running and bumming around, he thought he'd take it to another town. She was a chippy from Chicago, the only place she'd ever been before. She does her drinking from a gerbil jar. She keeps beneath the seat of the car. She liked to hit it from the get-go. She liked to hit it from the get-go. Old Cassandra and Polly Ann lived together on their father's land. Run off the neighbors one by one. Shoot out the stars and sleep in the sun. You know in life there ain't no accidents. Flunky creeping up along the fence. Flunky, he crossed Cassandra's soul. He's never gonna flunk no more. He's got to hit it from the, he's got to hit it from the get-go. He's got to hit it from the get-go. He's got to hit it. It ain't for you to reason why. You got to do before you die. You got to hit it from the, you got to hit it from the get-go. You got to hit it from the get-go. Roll the credits and fade to black. Flunky never gets his dollar back. He's gonna settle down in Kankakee every evening watching busted TV. There's a message coming from the screen. You got to listen to the in-between. Flunky finishes all of his chores to get to what's beneath the floor. He's got to hit it from the, he's got to hit it from the get-go. He's got to hit it from the get-go. He's got to hit it. He's got to hit it from the get-go. Get-go, baby. Get-go, get-go, baby. Get go. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
I I just love that song. It's like a double feature at the movies or something. It's really good. You know, you could be related to any one of these people. In fact, you could be one of these people. If you can't identify your sad sack relative, then it's usually you.
Yeah.
Your songs are really visual, and, you know, I mean, sometimes I can smell the old beer on the barroom floors. There's a vernacular that you choose that is really interesting for each of these songs, because it can be old-fashioned sometimes, but it's always sort of timeless in a way. You know, for instance, you use a word like chippy. She's a chippy from Chicago.
Yeah, chippy. I know guys that use that. Pat Cronin, you know, he was one of the owners of the Old Mermaid Lounge, and he would say, here comes this chippy, bah, you know, and he would.
But as a songwriter, when you write your songs, are you sort of putting out your wares for others to inhabit, or do you really write the songs for your own voice?
Maybe this just isn't my season, but I just can't see the reason for plying my feminine wiles. It's not the years, it's the miles.
Well, that song in particular I wrote for Trina Shoemaker to sing. Now, Trina Shoemaker used to live here. She was an engineer at Kingsway Studio, and she also engineered all those big Sheryl Crow records that won all the Grammys and stuff.
Sure.
But back in the day, she had said to me, if you write me a torch song, I will record your band. And this is, you know, back in the mid-90s. So I wrote that song for her, you know, and in that song I pulled that line, it's not the years, it's the miles. Well, it's a long story, but...
Well, let's hear it.
You want to hear it? Okay.
Yeah, we got the time.
I was in Maine, living, like, at my Aunt Joan's kind of commune.
Mm-hmm.
We were raking blueberries. So you get up really early, and you rake blueberries for a few hours, and then we were sitting in the car, my cousin, Kevin, and I, and there was this guy named Old Man, who was just this ornery, like, coot. I mean, like, he was like a kind of a redneck kind of guy, wore, like, these Wellington boots, jeans, no shirt ever, beard, you know, and he just would scream and holler all the time. He was,
and I think his name was Old Man?
His name was Old Man. I think he was from Arkansas or something. And he was and we're sitting there eating our tuna fish sandwich in the car, and like down like on, you know, in the field, not too far away was Old Man. He was screaming at something. And I said to Kevin, hey, you know, Old Man, he's really not that old. Why do they call him Old Man? And Kevin said, well, Alex, sometimes it's not the years, it's the miles. And I said to myself, man, that's a fun line, you know? So I really kept that in my back pocket. And then when Trina Shoemaker, you know, said, I want a torch song, I'm like, I got the title for you.
There kid. You go.
But now Debbie Davis has done it on her record, and she with strings and everything. So that's
right.
It's a song I wrote for a woman to sing.
I'm standing still and I'm all smiles. It's not the years, it's the miles. But once there was a time when I was able to drink 10 sailors under the table. But it soon becomes a bore when your name is on the lips of every sailor that wanders ashore.
It's not the years, it's the miles. A song written by Alex McMurray and performed by the fabulous Debbie Davis. Well, in radio, it's not the years, it's the minutes. And we've run out. This has been a special edition of Music Inside Out on WWNO. A generous contribution from you will help keep our show and all WWNO programming on the air. Listen to the people when they explain how to support the station. Obey them. You won't be sorry. I'm Gwen Tompkins, and this is Music Inside Out.
It's the mind.